Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're speaking with Max Mellman, author of Wonder Genes, Genetic Enhancement, and the Future of Society. So stay tuned. Speaking today with Max Mellman. Max is a professor of law and bioethics at Case Western Reserve University and the author of Access to the Genome and Wonder Genes, Genetic Enhancement and the Future of Society. Welcome, Professor Mellman.
Thank you.
We talk about this idea of genetic enhancement, but there's a kind of loosey-goosey set of definitions out there because some people consider some relatively therapeutic interventions to be enhancements, and some consider only things like wings to be enhancements. So what are you talking about when you talk about enhancements?
Yeah, it's a difficult distinction to make, but it's an important one to get down. Enhancements generally are interventions that change individuals. In my case, I'm interested in their physiology, their physiological or mental changes, in ways that exceed the sort of boundaries of normalcy in a society, and also that give them abilities that they would not otherwise have. So someone, for example, who starts off who is, say, 6 feet tall and who is able to increase his height by 6 or 7 inches, that would be an enhancement, even though someone who's 6'7" is not beyond normalcy in our society. But it also includes someone who goes from, say, 6 feet to 8 feet, which exceeds the bounds of society. The important thing is to distinguish between an enhancement, which is designed for a non-disease characteristic, and a therapeutic intervention, which has a sort of disease prevention or treatment intent in mind.
Now, that's a kind of funky definition in a sense, because all of these characteristics about humanity are slowly changing. The Flynn effect, I'm sure you're aware of, shows that the relative intelligence of people in the industrialized world has increased maybe 30 points in the last 100 years. So
that's right. This is a rolling phenomenon. And so, for example, we're a lot taller than our ancestors were, but still you can think about increasing height for people who are within a normal range or increasing height beyond the current population norms. And, of course, that'll differ from culture to culture.
So if I give a treatment, say a pharmaceutical treatment, to someone who has an IQ of 90 and it takes them to an IQ of 120, is that an enhancement?
It would be an enhancement unless we considered an IQ of 90 to be a defect or a disease, and that depends on how you consider, IQ. But certainly, say, if you took someone whose IQ was deemed to be a quote, normal IQ, like 100, let's say, increasing it in any way would be an enhancement. Okay, it would only be for someone who was, for example, retarded, however you characterize that, that it would be therapeutic. So it's a slippery definition, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about it.
That one seems to be problematic, because it would imply that you would only, if you wanted to avoid enhancements, you'd only be able to take somebody up to 100.
Well, again, depending on your goal, you could certainly enhance somebody up to within the normal range and still be considered therapeutic. For example, if you had the ability to enhance somebody's intelligence from, say, an IQ of 100 to an IQ of 200, assuming that 200 was still within the normal range of a society, you might say that that's still therapeutic if you think that their initial state is something that needs to be treated. But it's very subjective, and it's very fun, and it does change over time and over place.
Mm-hmm. How proximate do you think genetic enhancements are? I mean, there was just an announcement yesterday about a breakthrough with the use of naked DNA as a somatic gene therapy vector, and that's been the principal problem, is getting genes into existing bodies. We have more success with getting genes into pre-born bodies, but at both the reproductive stage and at the somatic stage, how far are we away from enhancements?
Well, let me sort of give you an idea of what the landscape of genetic enhancements looks like. At one end, you have germline gene transfer, which would include snipping out unwanted stretches of DNA at some stage in embryonic or fetal development that was early enough to affect the entire genome of that individual. And then you go sort of from that to gene therapy that could be, say, somatic gene therapy, where you're only you're not affecting their reproductive cells, so whatever changes you make are not passed on to future generations. And germline gene therapy is something that, or germline genetic enhancement, I should say, is something that's pretty far in the future, although there have been germline modifications already made in humans. The best example is something called ooplasmic transfer, where you take nuclear DNA from one individual and you can put it into an egg which has mitochondrial DNA from another. And so what you've essentially done is altered the DNA of the resultant in a way that will also affect all of their offspring as well. But that's certainly a far afield from doing it intentionally and doing it to produce some kind of change in the individual and producing some kind of an enhancement as opposed to therapeutic change. In terms of somatic genetic enhancement, as you point out, we're struggling with achieving a good technology for making those changes, and so far we've had really spotty success in humans, including a number of unfortunate deaths and the French infants who developed leukemia despite being apparently successfully treated for an autoimmune genetic autoimmune deficiency. So we've got a long way to go in those fields before we have genetic enhancement as a reality. But then we step back and we can think about, for example, decisions that are based in conjunction with in vitro fertilization, decisions that parents might take to pick amongst a number of fertilized embryos which ones they want to implant in the womb. And they're already doing that with regard to avoiding certain genetic diseases and defects, so to speak. But it won't be long before we can do it in connection with non-disease characteristics. And in fact, in a sense, we already do that now because some parents are choosing the genders of their embryos. And unless you think being male or female is a disease, that's an example already of kind of an enhancement type decision making at that stage. So you're not actually altering the DNA, but you are making, you're making a reproductive decision that will produce a, if you will, better child from your standpoint.
So you do include germinal choice at the level of among embryos, is it?
Right. And in fact, even going further, I would also include drugs that are made with recombinant DNA technology. Because indeed, that's part of our armamentarium of technologic interventions. And in that sense, we already have genetic enhancement available to us because, for example, people are using human growth hormone, which is made through recombinant DNA techniques to increase the height of children who are, certainly normal in height, and in some cases, we're told, who are already tall in height at the upper end of the population curve. And we also are aware that there are athletes who are using synthetically produced erythropoietin to give themselves performance enhancement benefits. So in that sense, some of this is already upon us, but the more powerful interventions, the ones that concern me the most, I think, are still in the future.
Is the use of, for instance, folic acid in a prenatal context to reduce the incidence of spina bifida, it's not, it only reduces the incidence of the expression of a genetic propensity, but wouldn't something in a prenatal context that reduces the incidence of having a genetic, a child with a genetic disorder, wouldn't that also be?
Well, it's a good question. You know, one of the confounding examples that you deal with when you're trying to distinguish between, say, therapeutic and therapy and enhancement are immunizations. That gives you an ability that you don't normally have to withstand a disease, disease insults. But I think the example of folic acid is a treatment. That's a treatment intervention because something is a treatment not only if it cures or treats disease, but also if it resists or creates a greater ability to stave off a disease condition. And since spina bifida is considered to be a disease condition, I think it would fit as therapeutic.
You're listening to Change Surfer Radio. This is Dr. J. I'm speaking with Professor Max Mellman. He's a professor of law and bioethics at Case Western Reserve University and the author of Wonder Genes, Genetic Enhancement and the Future of Society. So we're starting with issues that are with us today, from the sports to reproductive medicine to the attempts at various kinds of somatic interventions, and probably won't be fully with us as issues for another 15 years or so.
At least.
Yeah. But your book is an argument for why we need to begin to regulate these at not only a national level, but an international level. And I want to start with what I think is, for many people, most fundamental challenge here, for those who just don't have an initial yuck reaction, which is, I think, a very common one. But the counter reaction to that is my body, my choice. The argument that if you have the right to control your own body, most Americans think that they do, and that extends to procreative liberty, that they should be able to grow wings on their back or have green skin or have children with an extra 20 points of IQ.
Yeah, and those arguments are strong arguments, and they're one of the reasons why I take the position that that when you're talking, for example, about what I call passive reproductive enhancement, which is, for example, choosing which embryos to implant in IVF, which person to have a child with in the first place, based on, say, a genetic profile or matching genetic profiles, that's an area that I think the government has to stay away from because of the right to reproduce. But when it comes to active genetic engineering in the form of genetic enhancement and certainly germline genetic enhancement, the ability to govern your own body and the autonomy of making decisions for yourself stops at the point or becomes open to sort of public intervention at the point where it affects third parties. And I admit that the third party effects that I'm concerned about here are with one important exception, kind of abstract. They are the effects the effects on our belief in equality of opportunity, which stem from what I fear are the access limitations. The ability of only some people, presumably the wealthy, to get access to these technologies because of their cost. And I think that is it's an important concern. The question is it important enough? Will it become concrete enough so that we are moved to take sort of public steps to control to the way people get these technologies and how they use them?
Well, let's perseverate there for a second, because I think that that's quite a distinct set of arguments than you usually hear in this context, because particularly with Leon Cass in the bully pulpit of the President's Council, what we are hearing more commonly is Christian fundamentalist and kind of secular fundamentalist yuck factor arguments that we can't go beyond humanness. We can't, you know, we have to avoid a post-human future and all of that. You're making a very different argument, it seems, one based on the importance of equity and human solidarity.
That's right. I'm making a very much of an instrumentalist or consequentialist argument. As far as the argument that this is playing God or the yuck factor, I mean, one person's yuck is another person's playground. And as far as the hubris factor, if you take it seriously, I think the question is, who gave us the ability to do this if not the divine presence? So I think that in some sense this is our opportunity to seize control of our biological destiny in a way that we have not been able to do up until now. It's fraught with risk, but I can't accept an argument that it's somehow unnatural for us to try to do this. Now, my concerns are concerns based on the likely impact on society. As we see continued disparities between wealthy and the poor, this is the kind of advantage. I mean, this is like sending your kid to a super public, super private school, if you will. This is like giving your kid tremendous physical advantages over the kids who can't afford to have those. And it's in many ways it's the creating of a genetic aristocracy. I call them genobilities, and it's something that we've labored mightily in the last several hundred years to move away from, and replaced with the principle of merit to some extent. And this the risk of genetic enhancement available only to the wealthy, in my mind, threatens to sort of hurl us back into that unfortunate past. So. Let me go back to one thing earlier, and that is another instance in which society has an obligation to intervene is if we feel that parents are mistreating their children. And there's a real interesting set of issues about whether parents ought to be able to genetically enhance their children. And the main concern, a number of concerns have been expressed, philosophical objections to, sort of meddling with your child's natural genetic destiny. My concern is primarily the question of imposing health risks on the child in order to achieve an enhancement benefit.
If we can, let's just take health risks off the table, because I and I think almost everyone agrees that parents shouldn't intentionally use technologies which haven't been determined to be safe. And I think most parents wouldn't want to take the risk of creating monsters. But let me point you to an argument that Julian Savulescu's made, which is that parents have an obligation, of all the possible children that they can have, they have an obligation to have the children that have the best possible chances in life. And that, I think, leads you, in the context of enhancement medicine, to an argument that if I have the option of having a child with 100 IQ and an option of having a child with 140 IQ, it's my obligation to those not yet born children to choose the one with 140 IQ.
Right. Two problems. One is you can't really ever escape the risk issue because no intervention is entirely safe. If it were, then indeed I agree with you, we could get rid of the safety issue. So the question really is, you know, yes, you have an obligation to do the best for your child, but at what cost to the child? I mean, you know, so, you know, if you want to make your child into a world-class skater or a world-class musician, and in order to do that, you have to keep them indoors all the time that they're not in school and make them get up at 4 in the morning and practice, you know, is that an appropriate thing for a parent to be able to do? And I think reasonable minds can differ over that. The second thing is that you're right, and he's right, that there's going to be tremendous demand from parents and others to make this kind of opportunity available to their kids. But on the other hand, there are not only obligations to one's children, but also obligations to one's society, the society in which those children have to live and in which they hopefully will flourish. And those are the obligations that I think have to be considered when we think about public regulation of these technologies.
You raised this in the context or made the comparison to private schools, and I think many people have tried to parse out if there is any difference between genetic enhancement and the kinds of enhancement that we give to children in affluent homes through nutrition and stimulating environments in good schools. I think most people would balk at the notion that any parent has an obligation not to give their child the best possible education, even if it means that they completely dominate all the people in their milieu, at least in the United States. I mean, there are cultures that have much more solidaristic social values and where that's seen as a no-no, but not in the United States.
Well, we're not. That's right. We have developed a culture of you know, it's both at the one on the one hand it's extremely competitive, on the other hand it's extremely individualistic, and we've justified that by a variety of arguments such as trickle down economics and so on, all of which I think are highly questionable empirically. But in terms of public and private education, there is a wide range of tolerance for disparities in opportunity, but there is a limit to that tolerance as well. And this is a complex issue. It's a fascinating issue. But you know, we believe that if I don't have this opportunity, say to go to Harvard, at least my kids will. And that's really a bulwark, sort of a fundamental belief that allows us to tolerate so much frank inequality in society. One of those one of the corollaries to that is if they can send their kids to St. Paul's or at Choate or Exeter. I can't, but maybe my kids' kids will go there. But the problem with genetic enhancement is the potential that it will be so powerful and so outcome determinative, far more than the kinds of things we've seen so far, and far more than public than private education, that it will really interfere with that fundamental belief in equality of opportunity in a way that would be societally destructive.
It still is like making the argument that we should close down private schools because they have a negative impact on society. And I think what most people would argue is, look, if you're that concerned about it, why don't you make that quality of education available to everyone, and we could make the same argument for genetic enhancement.
Right. Because I'm not arguing closing down genetic enhancement, although I do argue that we have to consider a ban on germline genetic enhancement. What I'm considering is that it's really going back to some of the philosophies of the fellows who ran private schools in this country in the late 1800s, in the early part of the 20th century, and that was that in return for the privilege of this private education, you have a responsibility to use your gifts for societal benefit, not just for your personal gain. So what I've advocated in this book is that we consider the possibility of licensing users of these technologies, and it's a very complicated possibility, but it's one that I think we need to think about. In other words, to figure out ways of making sure that, by and large, people use these enhancements for societal benefit, not just for their own, and also a lottery for access to these interventions, in addition to allowing people who can afford to buy them in the free market. to preserve this, at least a sense of equality of opportunity.
Parenthetically, I argue for exactly the same thing in my book. So without knowing about your book, the last chapter of my book, which is forthcoming, is called Citizen Cyborg. I argue for licensing superpowers. For me, what I consider a superpower is something that's actually a threat to society, not just simply something that makes that exacerbates inequality, but something that is actually threatening.
Right. But, I look forward to reading your book because licensing is a difficult regime to impose. But here's let me just sort of give you a sense of where I come out on this. I mean, there's one alternative is a series of strong controls on these technologies, and another alternative is a series of more lax controls. And it seems to me what I do in this book is to figure out what strong controls would look like and what it would take to put them in place. But what I think we have to do is to establish methods to assess the need for those strong controls. We need some form of a kind of societal canary in the mine so that we can get a sense that, too many people are getting access to these enhancements. We're beginning to tip in favor of inequality in such a way that we really need to institute some kinds of controls. And so that's why I get concerned when a lot of people, particularly a lot of geneticists and researchers, say, this is science fiction. This is so far down the road. And by the way, if you talk this way, it threatens our funding, sources because they get scared. So stop this nonsense. And I think that's really, that's putting your head in the sand in a very dangerous way.
Well, let's talk about one of the regulatory difficulties here, because you apparently don't have any problem with adults doing things to their own bodies, if I get you correctly.
Except insofar as it gives them advantages over others that would so threaten equality of opportunity that Western liberal democracies, is founded on.
Okay. Well, here's the situation that I imagine might occur, and that is that we would have laws against germline genetic engineering,
okay,
so that you couldn't, in an in vitro context, change the germline of a future child.
Right. Although people would, do it on the black market.
They probably still, do it on the black market. But you would have somatic therapies. And if I had, if I wanted to be more intelligent and I started taking some kind of somatic genetic therapy that increased my intelligence, A, it might affect my reproductive cells in any case, and B, I could probably inject it in such a way or take it in such a way that it would increase the likelihood that it affected my reproductive cells and thereby pass on these genes. Now, you wouldn't be for a regime where people weren't allowed to have children if they had modified genes, would you?
Well, if the only way to prevent germline genetic engineering was to prevent reproduction by people who had done it, for example, if someone were to attempt germline genetic engineering, such as you're describing, it seems to me a legitimate punishment might be you can't have kids.
Okay, well, that takes us back to eugenics, doesn't it? I mean, the whole regime of eugenics was a notion of genetic incorrectness, that certain people would not be allowed or should be intentionally sterilized or forbidden from having children because they didn't have the right kinds of genes.
If, for example, this is a hypothetical, but if we in fact could identify, it would undoubtedly be a collection of genes and with a lot of other potential environmental factors, that produced a very high likelihood of some, socially extremely undesirable behavior. I think it is legitimate to prevent those people from exercising reproductive choice, absolutely, or at least limiting that choice. So, for example, you would identify the offspring. You would intervene if there were a way of somatically intervening to forestall that kind of behavior. You would watch them more carefully than other kids, and so on. Absolutely.
I'm sure you're familiar.
I mean, that's again pretty fanciful.
I'm sure you're familiar with Wickler et al.'s book, Chance to Choice.
Right.
And what they argue in that is that a liberty-respecting society that is also concerned about the things we're talking about equity and solidarity, that the only course available to such a society would be to maximize universal access to these enhancements and allow people to generally make the choice that they would, as you acknowledge, that they would make, which is that they would try to increase themselves and their children's collective utility. So why isn't that an option on your plate?
Cost. It's just a question. It's a question of cost. If we could afford it, that would be the best solution, which is, everybody would get it. And in fact, I've just written an article that's coming out in the fall in the Milbank Quarterly dealing with cognition-enhancing drugs, in which that is exactly what I say we should do. and that is, you know, treat them as we did Viagra in 1997 under Medicaid and make them available to anybody who wants them. But I don't think you can. I think my sense of and some of the drugs that are genetic enhancements under my definition, I think could be treated that way, assuming we felt they were safe enough. But when it comes to some of the more, IVF, in vitro fertilization costs, I think about $30,000, $35,000 a live birth. That's really well beyond the means of a lot of people, and it would be beyond the means of most of our, you know, third-party payment programs to make it available to everybody, not counting the cost of the genetic testing and manipulations that you'd have to add on to it. So I just think it's a question of cost. Maybe someday these technologies will become cheap enough that everybody or enough people will be able to take advantage of them, and the ones who can't, we can subsidize in some other way. That's certainly an option.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that you're going in that direction, because I don't think that the regime what we see with, for instance, antiretroviral drugs for HIV is that, yes, they were outrageously expensive and only available to the affluent for about 10 years, and then people in India figured out how to make it for a buck a day. And, with the progress that we're making with pharmaceuticals and genetic therapies, I can't see, especially when you take IVF off the table, as you just said, this is one of the reasons why I think that the scenario of people changing their own reproductive cells and having babies the natural way is far more likely than people all turning to IVF. But so you would only be for banning or strictly licensing those things until they're universally available.
That's right.
Well, that's delightful.
Glad to hear it. By the way, I'm not confident that would ever be the case. I just don't know if this could be ever be done, or at least in the foreseeable future, be done cheaply enough that it would be universally available. But if it were, again, assuming we felt it was safe enough, I that's definitely the way to go.
Well,
with
the
exception of germline genetic engineering, which I think has other issues. I mean, there, I think that, and they're really what you might call safety concerns, because they're the question of unknowable, unforeseeable consequences downstream. Let's put it this way. I think we would want to hold off on those, maybe voluntary moratorium amongst researchers or clinicians, until we felt really confident that we knew what we were doing. And that may not be that long.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, you're already an optimist in terms of genetic enhancement, arguing the policy of genetic enhancement, which most people in the field want to keep off the table because they don't really think it's that feasible. But
well, no, I mean, I think it's, the social benefits. I mean, the reason we don't want to try to prevent them or ban them altogether, not only aside from the fact that that's a practical impossibility, is the fact that we would lose enormous social benefit. I mean, there's no question. You know, don't we want our cancer researchers to have the best, you know, shot at curing cancer? Don't we want our, you know, soldiers to be as protected as we can get them, and so on?
Professor Millman, it's been a delight speaking with you. I've been speaking with Professor Max Millman. He's a professor of law and bioethics at Case Western Reserve University. He's the author of Access to the Genome and most recently Wonder Genes, Genetic Enhancement and the Future of Society, which is available now at bookstores, correct?
Correct.
So thank you very much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's jhughes, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.